Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. It's almost Christmas.
It is. Exciting.
In the middle of super crazy holiday season.
Definitely.
And we want to know what you're cooking, what you're eating, how you're entertaining, what your traditions are, what they used to be. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And tell us all about it or ask us questions if you're in deep trouble already.
Right. That's the kind of fun
thing. It's the 23rd of December.
Yeah, to be live today, I can just imagine everybody's cooking and, you know, if they might be listening, you know, it would be kind of fun to be able to like call in an emergency. Hey, you know, like this is happening right now. What can we do? Or we need a wine suggestion for this course or, you know, what temperature do I roast this at and how long? You know, that kind of fun stuff. So hopefully we can be your...
I was thinking deeper disasters than that.
Oh, like what? Like what could be possibly happening?
Yeah. These three things are supposed to take me 3 days to get done. And
right.
How do I live through that without drinking all the scotch?
Or, you know, what do I do when my braised lamb shanks aren't actually tender in time for dinner? There's no answer to that one.
Bruschetta?
Yeah. Slice it really, really thin.
So we'd started talking about this topic last time we were on in live.
And, mm-hmm. and lots of good calls.
And we had a couple of emails that we wanted to get to that were from last program, so but are on topic. One is Clifford's eggnog recipe, and I have a...
Oh, goody. Yes.
Very convenient photograph of a notebook page.
Wonderful.
Entitled Eggnog. A dozen eggs separated, 2 quarts heavy cream, 1 pound of powdered sugar, 1 quart of bourbon.
Wow.
1 cup of light rum.
Wow, that's a lot of bourbon, man.
Yeah, so far you're singing my song, Clifford.
Tony is coming over to your house, whoever you are.
Beat yolks till pale yellow, mix in sugar, add booze, splash at a time.
Yes.
Mix slowly with stand mixer, whipped cream till soft peaks. Whip egg white till soft peaks. Fold cream into booze. Fold whites into booze cream.
Yeah, man.
Allow to age.
Okay.
Fold once or twice a day.
That's exactly how my mom makes hers, although she doesn't use powdered sugar. She uses granulated sugar, but she doesn't put that much bourbon in hers. That would be the only difference between you and my mother. Grandma Tidwell's eggnog. I think it's a recipe she's been using like since... the 60s from McCall's Magazine or something like that. I think that's where it originally came from.
Grandma Tidwell's very...
Seriously good.
Seriously good. Frankly, I'm going to guess that Clifford from Baltimore.
Yeah.
I might have an eggnog with him.
All right. All right. My mom doesn't really want you to come over anyway, Tony.
I know how
okay,
that goes.
Okay, then.
Mary something.
Merry Christmas.
Louise in Glendon is on the line.
Hi, Mary Louise. Hi. I was wondering, what is the best way to cook a 8-pound beef tenderloin?
That's a big tender. Okay, so...
Has it already been cleaned up by the butcher?
Yeah, is the silvers off of it?
Trimmed and tied, yeah.
Trimmed and tied. Awesome. Do you have a grill?
I don't have a griller.
Oh, okay, got it.
It sounds like a no.
It's a big tenderloin. You need a big pan. If you don't have a grill to pop it on, which would be plenty of room, then you need a pan the size of the tender. Get that pan nice and hot, high heat. Put corn oil or some sort of neutral oil in it.
When you say big pan, you're not talking about a baking sheet of some sort.
I'm talking about a large saute pan.
A big saute pan, a big roasting pan.
Yeah, a roasting pan is perfect, which is probably the biggest pan most people have.
But lower-sided.
Yeah, if you have high sides on there, it's going to steam. So you need a short-sided pan. You would need a real saute pan, really. All clad produces a roasting pan, and the sides aren't that big. But like my mother's roasting pan, those like ones from the 50s, those things have very high sided pan sides. You wouldn't want to use that. So, okay, you get your pan hot. You go into the pan. Well, first of all, you want to season it first. If it's already tied, that means you're gonna miss a little bit when you're seasoning, but, you know, rub it well with salt and pepper. Don't overdo it on the pepper. A little bit of corn oil in that, too, would be good. Get it sort of oiled up. And then brown it on all sides. Just keep rotating it in the pan until it's really beautifully brown. Turn your oven to 300 degrees or 325 degrees and make sure your oven actually is at that is at that temperature. And
when you say brown it till it's almost crusty on the sides, relatively high heat.
High heat. You want to get caramelized.
Get a good sear.
Yeah. And then pop it in the oven. And an 8-pound tenderloin is big. I buy 5 pounds and down. So you probably got 25, 30 minutes to get to medium rare, but use a thermometer. That's the best solution because who knows what, you know, everybody's temperatures and ovens are different.
Mary Louise, do you have a pan that's going to accommodate this monster?
I hope so.
What you might do, I was just trying to think of if I had more limited things in the kitchen, whatever the heaviest bottom pan is that you can get a good sear, if you had to cut it in half so that the pan wasn't too small.
Yeah.
Still seared all the way around, and then if it had to go on a baking sheet or you know, into a lower side of a roasting pan in the oven, then that's fine. But to me, the sear is the most important thing because it's not going to take a tremendous amount of oven time to get it to a medium rare, you know, sort of internal
And
internal temperature. What do you think?
Also,
130?
125, 130. Also, the thing too with the amount of time you sear it also determines how much time you go into the oven with it, obviously, because you're cooking it when you're searing it. So if you're spending a lot of time searing it, just keep that in mind when you go into the oven.
Okay. How about the grill, though, if I did try to do that?
Oh, my gosh. I would totally do it on the grill, you know, if you have a pan problem, because it's just easy. That's what I do. When I make Wellington, I go onto the grill first. I don't try to put a whole tenderloin even in one of my pans in the restaurant. Of course, I have pans big enough to do it, but it's just easier to mark it off on the grill and roll it around on there.
We're not thinking about yours has been tied.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yours has
Why
been
is it
tied?
You sure you have a beef tenderloin?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody tying a beef tenderloin. There's really nothing to tie.
Okay.
Yeah, but
that's true.
You may catch your butcher twine on fire on a grill. So, is it stuffed? Is it stuffed?
No. No.
I wish I could see
a
picture
plain
of it.
Old beef tenderloin.
are you hunting sauce or garnishes or anything like that?
I was thinking of mushroom sautéed with shallots and port wine, some Stilton in there, and a little bit of creme fraiche.
I think.
You
kind of lost me with the Stilton.
You lost me with the Stilton.
Only because I think we both love Stilton cheese,
mm-hmm.
but I think I'd make one choice or the other because if you do
either do the dairy products or do the port and the mushrooms and the shallots. Pick one.
Oh, okay.
Go in one direction.
If you want to do a very easy version of the Stilton, if you love the blue cheese beef thing, and I do too,
definitely.
You can make a compound butter with Stilton and just nice fresh butter.
Okay.
You know, and roll that up.
Slice it. Roll it. Chill it. Slice it.
Yeah, and then when you have the slices of the beef, you could just have that, you know, let it the warm slice have it melting on there and.
Well, and also the nice thing about roasting it is that you could add near the end of the cooking time when you're pulling out the tender to let it rest before you slice it, you can use that pan if it's in good shape to cook the mushrooms, deglaze it with the port, and really make a great sauce with that. You might want to balance out your port with a little bit of red wine as well, because port can be very, very sweet, and if you add a little bit of red, it just kind of gives it some balance between the acid of the red wine and the sweetness of the port, if you want.
All right. Thank you.
Have fun.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Good luck.
Enjoy that beef.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes, ma'am. And so you're listening to us live. It's 410-662-8780. If you have other searches for advice or fixes we can help you with, or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And I have an email here from Kathy. My family and friends have come to expect the butter cookies I make from a recipe that must be nearly 100 years by now.
Wow.
My grandma Agnes from Old Country, Croatia, made these, then my mother Anne, and now me. A couple of my nieces have made these as well. You'll note ingredients are whole foods and farm-based. I have fond memories of helping my mother decorate these cookies. She said my small fingers, as a little girl, were perfect for adding the little silver balls to the Christmas tree shapes.
Oh, that's neat.
A pound of butter unsalted, 6 raw eggs, 6 hard-boiled egg yolks, 2 cups of butter, grated rind of a large lemon and its juice, 8 to 9 cups of flour. Cream the butter and the sugar, mix in eggs and lemon, add flour. By the time I get to 5 to 6 cups, I have to knead this by hand. Chill the dough, roll out and use cookie cutters, egg wash, sprinkles of sugar and nuts, bake. So we'll make, depending on size, between 200 and 300 cookies.
Wow, that's a good recipe.
And it's satisfying, buttery, and not too sweet. That's
yummy. I've never heard of
that's
boiled
a lot of cookies.
Egg yolks in a cookie dough. That's super cool.
Oh, you've seen
I love that.
Certainly seen it in a lot of recipes over the years.
Neat.
What is your favorite Christmas cookie?
Oh my gosh, it's hard to answer.
No, but number one.
Oh God, don't pressure me. sheesh. I really, really, really loved my mother's sand tarts, which were, you know, a sugar cookie dough, and they're a lot of work. And she always rolled them out like paper, not paper thin, but just a little bit thicker than that. They were always thin and just like super delicate and full of butter. And I love those. And of course, as a kid, I always liked making, she made a cream cheese cookie that, you know, back in the day we used that press thing. And I got to, you know, it's like the lady was talking about with the Croatian cookies. You know, it was always so much fun to get to help her, you know, do the different shapes, little wreaths and Santa Clauses and whatever with the sparkling sugar, which, you know, I've always liked anything that sparkles. So I still do to this day. And, so those are fun. But really, truly, my favorite cookies are snickerdoodles. I love snickerdoodles.
Let's talk to Melissa in Bolden Hill, who has a holiday recipe to share for Banya Kaura.
Hi, Melissa.
Melissa, how are you?
Hi, guys. I listen to you almost every weekend.
Thank you.
Very sweet.
My mother grew up on a farm in Missouri without electricity or running water.
Wow.
With no Italian heritage whatsoever, we somehow ended up with Banya Kaura every Christmas Eve.
That's all right.
Wonderful.
That can be awesome.
It's the best. And it's easy. It's just lots of garlic, really good anchovies and really good olive oil. And if you want to jazz it up a little, you can add a little half and half or a little balsamic vinegar. And then if there are any leftovers, which there never are, you can use it for a dressing. And it's wonderful to toss linguine and shrimp with.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yum.
But mostly we just had, you know, good crusty bread.
How nice.
Blanched asparagus and Belgian endive leaves. And celery with the leaves, because that's where all the flavor is.
You bet. That's great. That's nice, Melissa.
It's the best, and it's just this wonderful dipping thing that we would do when we opened our presents on Christmas Eve and have sparkling wine in front of the fireplace.
Wonderful memories.
That's fun.
That's lovely.
And I suggest everybody make it, because it's just incredible.
Any Piemontese cookbook is going to have a Banya Kaura recipe.
That's awesome.
Just to be trivial, do you know what Banya Kaura means?
No, I don't.
Hot bath.
Ah.
You're taking these room temperature vegetables on a cold day and dipping them into a hot bath.
Wow,
it's a very like garlicky anchovy kind of bath, but yeah.
I would bathe in it myself. If I did. But after you eat enough of
you're
it,
you're a
you
bold woman,
like
Melissa.
Have, so.
That's awesome. Thanks, Melissa. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Have a great holiday.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
That's nice.
Okay. Let's go to Anne in Annapolis.
Hi, Anne.
Anne, go ahead.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Cindy. I have a question in the beef vein, and then I also have some information to share about a port I just opened.
Good.
So I'll start with the question. So every year we do standing rib roast. Mm-hmm. My mother and father's families are from Wales and Scotland, so we have to do that with Yorkshire pudding. And
of course.
I'm kind of just interested in some different sides this year. I'm kind of bored with my sides, so I'm wondering if you folks have any suggestions on, and it's all, of course, on the same plate with the Yorkshire and the standing rib roast.
I will admit, with beef, especially beef that's a little bit fattier, deliciously so, like a rib roast.
By the way, it is tied, of course. So there
That should be tied. That should be tied. That's a different cut of beef.
That is the tied roast,
yeah.
The things that I like the most, I think, are not so much the mashed potatoes and that sort of business, but
yeah.
It's something with strong flavors that's kind of bitter, honestly. So Brussels sprouts, turnips, mm-hmm. Those are the things that I end up getting the most excited about.
Mm-hmm.
I will admit, a lot of times for me, I want the wine to be, if something is rich and salty and fatty and they're like strong bitter flavors there, wine is especially sweet with that. So you take something, especially if you're opening some more mature from Bordeaux or from Piemonte, like a Barolo, then that shows off all the fruit in those wines too.
Mm-hmm.
You need something like that to handle a dish like that. But but sprouts are easy, and frankly, I don't like Brussels. Brussels just roasted in the oven with fresh garlic or tossed in a pan, made just a slightly caramelized after blanching with fresh garlic is great. Even a little bit of balsamico is nice to have for that.
My suggestion is a cauliflower gratin. You can make it ahead. It's, you know, you can serve it in the dish that you make it in. Cauliflower loves beef, and you can just blanch the cauliflower. You can either slice it or break it into florets and blanch it in nicely salted water. And then, you know, lay it out in your dish with a little bit of cream, maybe Gruyere, Reggiano, a little bit of salt and pepper. And you could even mix something else in. I love roasted cipollinis. They're so pretty. And you could, you know, just add a little treat of having like little cipollinis scattered in amongst the gratin. And then it's in and out, you know, of the oven and even can sit, you know, somewhere kept warm for a period of time while you're getting everything together. So that makes...
Yeah, I'm messing with the Yorkshire, which is kind of finicky anyway.
Right, yeah. Got yeah. it. Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about the port.
Well, so my grandparents apparently went to Portugal in the early 50s. And when we were cleaning out their house a couple of years ago, in their cellar we found three bottles, 1900, 1918, and 1927.
Wow.
27 is a very storied year. 27 and 37 are very famous for being long-lived wines.
Yeah, I'm sorry, and also 1921. So a couple of days ago, I was having a little holiday with a friend of mine who is a chef in Chicago, a French guy from Normandy, and I decided to open the 21. And it was unbelievable, extraordinary, and had no idea what to expect because I didn't know how well it had been cellared. I assumed it was okay, but oh, my goodness, just extraordinary flavors. But interestingly, the precipitates. Had the bottle was, you know, had so much precipitate in the bottom, the cork was very wet and the wine was very clear, but it had every flavor you would expect from an old port.
Yeah, that it's crazy. There's almost like a mincemeat pie character to those, you know, or like mincemeat pie while smoking a cigar kind of a flavor of some of those wines.
Yes. Yeah, it was really extraordinary, and that I'm dead sure that was the oldest wine I've ever had, and I just wanted to share that with you because
I'm very jealous. I've never had a 21. I've had a lot of old wine, and I've had a lot of old port, but I've never had... I've had 21 from Chateau Palmer, Chateau Margaux, and Bordeaux, but never 21 from a port house. Which house?
Fonseca.
Mm. Well, good for you. Yeah. What an amazing
house, style.
Thing to find.
That's great.
Gosh.
Oh, happy holidays,
yeah,
Anne.
Yeah, so and also there's a Muscatel, 1913 Muscatel. Not sure what we're going
to
find there.
Should be fun to explore.
To that with you.
Depending on the alcohol level and who the producer was there, it could be a lot.
Yeah, so. And I'm really surprised that it actually, you know, was okay because thinking about them bringing it back from Portugal in the early 50s and you know what travel was like then, mm-hmm. and it was already 30 years old at that point.
Those wines are made in a pretty robust style, especially vintage port in those days.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Well,
Anne.
Thank you, Anne. Have great
sharing.
Holidays.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, and I also wanted to tell you about our Christmas Eve tradition because my Scottish family, when they came to the U.S., they moved to New Orleans. We have shrimp creole.
Oh, that's a good tradition. Love it. Love it. Good.
Awesome.
Yum. All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks for your suggestion.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Bye. When we get back in just a moment, Harvey, please stay on the line. You can reach us 410-662-8780. Send us an email, foremanwolf@wypr.org. We're talking about holiday traditions, holiday recipes. If you've got something wacky that you have to share that's connected to the holidays or a ridiculous food story or something that needs to get repaired, fixed, a plan that you want assistance with, we can give you a hand. All of that and more on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
Sorry, and Chef Cindy Wolf. That was weird.
You were surprised what my name was?
It's just weird the way you did that. Anyway, it's all good.
What name did you think I was going to use?
You never know, Tony. All right, so let's talk to Harvey.
For God's sake, let's talk to Harvey. Harvey, go ahead.
Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Cindy. It's great to talk to you guys. How are you doing today?
Great.
Good. How are you? You have a good voice for the radio, mister.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm hoping you guys can give me a bit of advice today. So my wife and I were hosting a couple of friends for a small gathering for Christmas. And I've made beef Wellingtons before. It's kind of become a tradition for us to make a beef Wellington. Well, this year, saving a bit of money, after watching an episode of the British Baking Show where they did different kinds of Wellingtons, I wanted to try my hand at a lamb Wellington. Lamb Wellington. And we picked up a leg of lamb, but reading more about how to cook these things, because I haven't cooked like whole cuts of lamb before, it's got to come to an internal temperature that's fairly high to get cooked through. And so I'm wondering if I should cook the leg off like the day before, season it and everything, do everything that I want to do there, cook it off the day before, refrigerate it until I am ready to wrap it in the puff and then bake it off the rest of the way. Or if there's any other approach I should do to make sure that the leg gets cooked completely without turning this puff pastry into ash.
Got it. So out of curiosity, is it boned, rolled, and tied, or is it bone-in?
It's boned.
Oh, good. Okay. Is it tied? Does it have butcher twine around it?
Not yet.
Okay. So you can't have butcher twine on something that you're going to wrap in puff pastry. Let's start there. There's a lot of things to address here. You've got a tough piece of meat. So when you do beef Wellington, you use a tenderloin, which is the most tender piece of meat. So I'm a little bit worried about you doing this, quite frankly.
It may not be a good cut to do it with.
It's definitely not a good cut. I'll just be honest. I'm not going to beat around the bush. It's not a good cut.
I was trying to be nice.
I'm not. I want him to be successful, and it's not. And it's a huge piece of meat, and it's not. I mean, and when you say cooked through, do you mean well done? Are you going to cook it till it's well done?
I'm going to cook it till it's medium rare, I think. Things that I've looked at have said in the 145 range.
Okay. So out of curiosity,
145 is probably medium, which honestly is a nice temperature.
Medium is good
for
leg of lamb. Yeah, I don't cook leg of lamb medium rare typically. I think leg of lamb, because of its different muscles within the leg, it medium is better. Now, when you make your Wellington, I'm curious, you wrap it in pastry. Do you put anything in the Wellington, around the Wellington? Is there any other ingredient when you do the beef Wellington?
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, use the Duchelles and the, what do you call that stuff? The thinly sliced pig, prosciutto.
You put prosciutto and do you mean mushrooms? Are you talking about mushrooms?
Okay. Mushroom duxelles.
All right. So, that would be okay. Both of those things would be amazing in with the lamb. I'm going to suggest something to you, as a different approach, which is you take your pastry, you put it on a board, use a cutter of some sort. It can be a circle cutter, a square cutter, if you have any cutters. And you cut out puff pastry and you bake it. You wash it, you cut it, you wash it with egg wash, which is a whole egg with a little bit of water in it mixed together with a whisk or a fork. And you wash it and you actually just bake pieces of puff pastry. And then you have your slices of beef. You garnish with your duxelle if you still want it. Your prosciutto is now room temperature and not cooked, which is the best way to serve it. And you can garnish with your puff pastry. That is a makes sense to me. I mean, it's creative, it's unusual, but all the components will come together that way. That way you can just cook your leg of lamb to the temperature that you want it to. You don't have to worry about anything burning, or it's just too big of a piece of meat to wrap in puff pastry.
It's a fairly small leg, but yeah, it is sizable, mm-hmm. Compared to when we've done it with beef in the years before.
And the only thing I would say to you is, otherwise, if you're determined to wrap it in pastry, do what you said, which is, you know, mark it off, get it nice and roasted, cook it to almost the temperature that you need it to be. And I would then, you know, when you feel like you've got 15 minutes left of cook time and you can turn that oven up to 425 degrees, wrap it in the pastry. I don't know if this is going to work, but then you would wrap it in pastry, put it in the oven for the remaining time. Or this is a good one.
Yeah.
Cut it in half, you know, and then wrap it in pastry and have two units to roast.
Yeah. I was going to suggest
like smaller Wellingtons. I actually really like the idea of the sort of deconstructing it.
Yeah. I think you'll be successful with that.
You know what?
There's no question with that.
You could
that's
take
the
puff pastry and the mushroom duxelle and the prosciutto and makes almost like a forced meat with the duxelle and the prosciutto and put that inside of puff pastry and let that rise and you have like little tarts.
Yeah.
And serve that as a garnish for
you can definitely
the thin
fool around
roasted
fool
lamb.
Around with the components and make it work. But yeah.
You want to roast the lamb as the lamb. That's,
yeah, I would.
Sear it well.
Especially since you have to feed some people. This is pretty risky what you're trying to do. Quite frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe do it this way, deconstruct it as you use that term, and then some Sunday when you don't have to feed people and it's just you and your wife and, you know, maybe just play around with it. But I think you need to do it the way that I suggested.
I really like that. I think that's what I'm gonna go for.
Sorry.
Yeah, how many times
like
a day
work,
do you
it's
say
like you
that?
Work for me right now.
I would love to. Oh, that would be a fantastic job.
That's nice. Thank you, Harvey.
Harvey,
thank you,
you know not of what you speak.
Jesus. Okay. Thank you, Harvey.
Bye, Harvey.
Happy holiday. All right.
Thank you all. Happy holidays.
Yeah, no teasing allowed before the holiday, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, should we go to Marjorie
and
Woodstock?
Yeah, let's go to Marjorie and Woodstock.
Hi.
So, you had a ham question.
Hello? Yes, I have a ham question. So I have a ham that I bought from a friend of mine who's a farmer and raises heritage pigs, and it's smoked, but it's not fully cooked. And I'm not sure what the best way is to cook it so that it comes out tender and whatever. Mm. I'm not worried about the flavor. It's not one of those heavily salted Smithfield kind.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm a little stumped by this one, too.
Ham that's smoked that's not cooked.
Cooked.
So it's been cold smoked?
Right, like bacon.
Was it cured?
Oh. Yes.
Okay, so it really is like a giant piece of bacon.
Okay, then you can just roast it in the oven.
Then treat it like a giant piece of bacon.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with Tony. Yeah, that's, and you might even, does it have a nice amount of fat on the outside of it or not?
It's got some.
Okay.
Not a huge amount.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get that crispy, so that's going to be your goal there. So I would maybe turn up my oven temperature near the beginning of the process, maybe for 15 minutes, you're at 425, and then you drop it down to, say, 325 for the rest of the cook time. But yeah, that I think that's your solution.
And that's a pretty good excuse to do something spice-wise on the outside of the ham, because it'll perfume it, you know, whether it's sort of the old-fashioned thing, whether it's cloves or it's star anise. Or...
Yeah, and also in your roasting pan, you're going to come up with some pretty good fat in there from that ham. So you could also, you know, cook some vegetables in there with it, whether it's potatoes or Tony was talking about turnips earlier, root vegetables, any root vegetables. But, I mean, you're going to come up with some fat if that's not, you know, if you're okay with that. You could get some really good flavor into some roasted vegetables, carrots.
Yeah, beets, golden beets.
Yeah, golden beets would be great. Okay.
And then it's got to come up to about 160?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Okay.
All right.
If you pull out of the oven in the low 160s, it'll rest up the rest of the way.
And if it's a relatively good-sized piece of meat, consider that you may have to let it rest for like 15, 18 minutes. You know, you've got a pretty long rest time on a good-sized piece of meat. And maybe just pop some foil over it, like just, you know, not tightly, but just, you know, to keep some temperature in, but also let it rest. And you and, okay. and I would also say slice it thin so that you're not having mm-hmm. any issues with, if it is tough, you know, that you're,
right.
you're as thin as you can slice it. That would be good. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Thanks,
Happy holidays.
Marjorie. Happy holiday.
Bye-bye.
So we're live. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. I think we've got an email here. This is from Susan Towson. Back in the 70s and 80s, my grandmother always made fresh ham for Christmas.
Mm.
We're in the ham portion of the program.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of her childhood Christmas on the farm. Her grandchildren weren't fans of the fresh ham and dreaded Christmas dinner at her house. Is there a way?
Oh my gosh, I nothing love like fresh ham.
Nothing like a bitter family story.
Aww.
Smart aleck as usual. Is there a good way to make fresh ham?
Yes. Fresh ham is amazing. I mean, it's just, first of all, especially if the bone is in it. I mean, it's going to be delicious. And again, I would roast it the way that I would roast anything. You know, start it off at 425 for 15 minutes and knock it down to 325 or 300. And if you have a convection oven, I would not have the convection on. I would turn it off and just
roast
low and slow and just let it go. I would season it really well with salt and pepper. And you could certainly rub in a little bit of fresh rosemary or a combination of rosemary and thyme, a little bit into the fat. You could score a little bit of the fat on the outside of the ham so that the seasoning really gets rubbed into it. I would avoid anything like garlic or shallots just because it's going to burn. So, you know, but again, at the end of that roast time, you've got a pan that's going to, you know, you'd add a bunch of great vegetables
if you're going to deal with garlic and shallots and things
you
like that.
You could add it at the end.
Work with it at the end and
sure.
the fat.
In the last little bit of cook time. Yeah. Fresh hams are delicious.
They can be. And you don't see them very often. It's probably something you have to order.
So, you know, when we did our show last week, we were talking about, you know, entertaining and everything and having an open house. You had an open house after the show. Did you do anything that you want to share, like fun things that were super successful for you? Because I had a party too after the show.
There was a really silly, very quicky little goat cheese mousse.
Good.
It seemed like it was the most popular thing that was there. And it was just fresh goat cheese, olive oil, mascarpone, and a little bit of very sweet garlic from being poached.
Good.
With crostini and lots of vegetables.
So the crostini was separate? You didn't put it on it?
Yeah. And I put it alongside a plate of salami. And really good verrucco chorizo, right?
Oh.
So nice, smoky, and spicy chorizo.
Nice. That sounds good.
And then I had some gougere and made some others. The others sort of failed. They were very tasty, but they came out very flat.
Huh. What were the other ones?
So they sort of, they looked like discs or something. So a brilliant person walked over. Took a scoop of the goat cheese mousse, put a piece of chorizo on it, and a piece of petit basque from another
Ooh,
plate.
Nice.
And started making sandwiches.
Well, there you go. Well,
that was just amazing.
Good
so
when things like that.
It's funny when you
come out of a mistake.
You have a lot of things that are nice. You just mm-hmm. put them out, and smart people figure out what to do with them, right?
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was good. Did you serve anything fun?
Yeah, well, I made Wellington. It's funny that Harvey talked about doing the lamb Wellington. I made Wellington, which I was super excited about. But that, you know, everything's a learning experience, no matter if you're a professional chef or not. It's the first time I am living in a new home, and I have an oven that I've never used before. And, you know, my Wellington got a little cooked more than I wanted it to. So that was pretty frustrating for me. But, you know, that's the thing, you know, sort of like the lamb thing, it's best to do something obviously ahead of time. And of course, I'm a little bit more confident because this is what I do professionally. But nevertheless, it comes down to the fact that I've never worked on that oven and it didn't work the way I needed it to. But one of the things, because I did the Wellington, I had a bunch of trim. And so I made steak tartare, which was extremely popular.
Which was not ever cooked.
Oh my gosh, no, that was completely raw. And I made it differently than I've ever made it. I do like capers in there, and I added pichelin and Niçoise olives to it. Oh gosh, and a little bit of shallot, a little bit of fresh chive, and a little bit of basil, and extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, no egg, nothing else. And it was, oh my gosh, people went crazy for that.
That's fun.
That was fun. I made
it's
a bunch
sort
of raw.
Like a raw beef tapenade sort of thing.
Exactly. It was, yeah, well, I love tapenade with beef tenderloin when it's roasted, so it only made sense. I also, I hadn't made remoulade in a long time, and that's one of my favorite, you know, sort of Creole, sort of mayonnaise-y things for shrimp. And, you know, people just get excited when they see giant, you know, chilled shrimp. So I had chilled shrimp with remoulade, and remoulade's easy to make. It's mayonnaise, a little bit of whole grain mustard, fresh lemon juice, Tabasco, and I usually put chives in, and sometimes, and this time I put horseradish in, and it was, that was fun. So that was popular.
Sounds good. That's, I like remoulade very much.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back, you can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org, and we'll see if the phone's quiet down, if we can sneak in a chef's challenge. If not, we're very happy to answer your questions,
yes,
and listen
definitely
to your stories. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live. You can reach us 410-662-8780. We have a stack of emails. You can still reach us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And let me get to a couple
this
of these.
This is great. I love it.
That's we love hearing
really
people's
do
stories and
absolutely
comments and the recipes. And the okay, this is from Camille. My mother made a wonderful fruitcake, which I then made for years until I could only find chopped up candied lemon peel, orange peel, and citron. Is there a way to buy a whole lemon peel, orange peel, and a half small citron? The recipe also calls for crystallized cherries and 3 slices of pineapple as well. I am unsure of the weights of these ingredients, and thus I will appreciate suggestions.
Yeah. Mm. I know how to buy them commercially, but I don't know where you can get that, you know, retail. So maybe, I think for me, the only suggestion I would have is to look on the internet, because it seems to be a great source. But I've never seen those things. You know, people must not make fruitcake and things that much anymore.
Well, pastry supply specialty sites is the one thing that,
mm-hmm,
you know, that I would check. But yeah, I don't know of a local place that you can
but
go and just buy it off the shelf.
That's sort of sad because those things used to be everywhere. Yeah. That's what happens when there's no demand.
Yeah, my great-grandmother mm-hmm always had then, and I would sneak many pieces of candied orange. Edie in Hamden says, the Wonder Bag is my favorite way to transport hot things to potlucks. No need to have the host or hostess give up oven space.
Ooh, that's awesome.
And the purchase benefits those in need. So that's
it's called
great
a Wonder Bag?
Wonder Bag Portable Slow Cooker.
Oh, that's excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Eco-friendly, powerless, portable slow cooker that gives you the healthiest meals possible.
That's excellent.
That's great.
That's a great tip.
And from Valerie, originally from Fort Wayne, Indiana, but now from Catonsville. I was so surprised and happy to hear that sand tarts are your favorite Christmas cookie, Cindy. Christmas cookie, Cindy, is hard to say. They're a family tradition from your mom's and my mom's German Lutheran family.
That's true.
She and her brothers made them each Christmas.
Wait a minute. Who is this from?
Valerie.
Okay.
Originally from Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne is nowhere near where you grew up.
I grew up Elkhart, Indiana.
Okay.
Fort Wayne's not that far away.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I lived in North Carolina when I was little, but
one of my sisters and I have carried on the tradition.
That's amazing.
And have passed it down to at least one of our children, so hopefully it will continue for
good
generations to come.
That's great.
These cookies are so important to us that last spring, when I visited my aunt in California, she had a Tupperware container in her kitchen with the last 2 sand tarts that my uncle made for me at Christmas 2015. Sadly, he passed away 4 days later.
Oh.
I'm making mine today.
Very nice. Thank you, Valerie.
Here we go. Here's a question up my alley. From Carolyn. I'm making Brandy Alexanders for my Christmas guests. And I'd like to serve another drink to counter the creaminess of the first. Something with sparkling wine and fruit, maybe. I mean,
sparkling wine and fruit.
There's a lot you can do. The world is fueled by mimosas, it seems like, Sunday midday. But any kind of any kind of fruit. There are a lot of cocktails. I mean, there are a lot of cocktails that are super trendy right now. The ones that have a little sparkling wine float are pretty fun. That's also a way to lighten up a cocktail. You're in the time of the year when tropical fruit starts to become available. I would look for something in that vein. I'm not going to give a particular recipe. And a little bit like when you add, there's some things that I would not put together. I love sparkling wine. I love champagne.
Mm-hmm.
And I...
Me too.
I struggle putting things in it.
I agree.
But I understand using it to ameliorate something else.
Right. Or you could do maybe something, you know, that produces a sparkling feeling, and then you could do like... you know, that way you're not using champagne and, you know, club soda and adding, you know, passion fruit or something like that, right?
Or if you want something old-fashioned that you know, looks holiday, serve Negronis.
What's that?
Bright red.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And you just need, the quality of the Negronis really has to do with the quality of the gin, the vermouth you choose.
Mm.
You know, it's just three ingredients, those and Campari.
I want a cocktail for Christmas with cranberries in it, like cranberry puree or some sort of cranberry garnish. You know how
I'm sure everyone at this station would like a cocktail for Christmas with cranberries in it. And if you had been considerate, you would have showed up for the show today with a small pitcher of them.
Oh boy!
And I would have been reading,
driving down the road even more unsuccessfully. Of cocktails. That wouldn't put me in jail or anything for Christmas.
No.
Oh god!
No,
this shows.
It certainly happened enough when I was a kid.
Oh my gosh!
I grew up in a
do you have a Christmas
household.
Story, Tony? I want to hear a Christmas story from you, please.
So, I have a Christmas story because every year the Feast of the Seven Fishes is on my mind.
Okay.
Everyone thinks of it as being this huge Italian tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing about it is it's an Italian-American immigration tradition. It's really the story of, you know, how being Italian coming to the U.S., how they would celebrate traditions from their past, but it's not, it's not the same. I mean, that's, Italians in Italy really don't, you know, we have so many people that love to celebrate Feast of the Seven Fishes, whether it's seven types of seafood in your dinner or seven seafood courses or many different preparations of a couple of fish.
Is that in one sitting?
That is in one sitting.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And an easy way to do it, for example, is to do three cold antipasti, you know, maybe something pickled or maybe something grilled.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something that's made into a, you know, a mousse or whatever
or
it might
tartar be. Tartar or
yeah, bruschetta.
Ceviche.
Like,
well,
yeah, I mean.
Or some sort of,
There's a million, there's a million simple antipasti that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And a crudo, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then pasta with a couple of more types of seafood. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's
So it doesn't have to just
clams
be fish.
And mussels. No.
It can be all seafood. Okay.
And maybe one nice roasted fish, a branzino or something.
That would be nice.
Have as main course.
Mm-hmm.
But in Italy, it's Cena della Vigilia, the night before Christmas. And usually you would not eat meat before a big holiday, right?
Okay.
But there are certain dishes, like every region, every place, there are certain dishes that make it up. Maleredos in Sardinia is what you would have on Christmas Eve with tuna and cherry tomato, whether fresh or preserved.
Oh, yum.
And that's Maleredos, the little like drum-shaped pasta. You remember those guys?
Mm-hmm.
Little
definitely.
Like a little semolina gnocchi.
Delicious.
Or in Rome, it's always a fish soup, minestra di pesce, that would be served. In Piemonte, you always serve agnolotti.
Ooh.
And usually not any kind of sauce. It's usually there's like a richer filling. You know, maybe a little more calf's liver and with the veal and the pork and the filling.
You're making me extremely hungry now.
So, but that's...
Wow, that sounds so good.
I think it's kind of interesting, and I think that Italian-Americans especially should be proud that, you know, that there's this tradition that's really, it's ours, you know, that really has to do with the early 1900s and coming to the States, and I don't know, I find that kind of cool.
It is cool.
100 plus years later.
I just love traditions. They're so amazing.
How about...
Well, you know, with...
How about you? What is your... your Christmas tale?
I think for me, Christmas, you know, was always about all the things that my mother did that made the house so special. And, you know, on Christmas Eve, we always had, the whole house was lit with candlelight. I will never forget that as a child. So it's more of that type of memory than it is necessarily food, because quite frankly, I feel like my mom made different things. Like they were, you know, we were talking about fresh ham. I recall having fresh ham. I recall having a baked ham. I recall having turkeys. And definitely my father was in the meat business, so we would often have a big beef roast. So it was different often. You know, obviously my mother's cookies were absolutely amazing. So that was something we all just could not wait for. And, you know, so I think it was really more the feeling. My mother was just so good at creating this just very magical feeling in our home. And, you know, the whole thing of coming downstairs in the morning and seeing the tree with all the gifts and just being together as a family. And my father traveled a lot when I was a child, and or all of my life, really. And, you know, he was obviously always home at Christmas. And so it was just a very special family time. And that's what it should be. You know, that should be the important part of it, is the religious aspect and also just being together as a family. So I cherish those memories.
It's interesting. You mentioned Santa, and I recall being just fascinated with the whole idea. You know, and there's so much
of Santa Claus.
Santa has great PR, right?
Yeah.
In the U.S., especially when we're living, just amazing. And my five-year-old, we ask her, does she want to go see Santa Claus? You know,
yeah.
That's, you can see Santa Claus at the mall or various places during the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, not really. I have Santa Claus with me all the time.
Oh, that's too cute.
And I thought it was cute, and then I was like, oh, geez, that's some deep thinking right there.
Well, that's cute. That's very cute.
Yeah,
that's sweet. Oh, that's nice. Children are amazing.
All right, last email from Rachel. There is a kitchen store in Philadelphia called, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Fante, if it's French, that carries the candied fruits for fruitcake and stolen.
Good.
That's awesome.
Oh, good. Thank you.
They are whole pieces of candied peel and citron that can be chopped up how you like and taste a lot better than the mix from the grocery store. It is in the Italian market. So that's, you know, Christian and Catherine, 8th and 9th, right in that area of Philadelphia. That's great.
That's a great thing about community, when people help each other and, you know, someone asks a question and gets it answered. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's great. That's great. Thanks
thank
a lot
you.
For that response, and thanks a lot for listening today. And throughout the course of the year, you can still shoot us an email, foremanwolf@wypr.org. We'll get back to it on the next program. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on email, I'm sorry, I can't speak English today.
You can follow me on Instagram as Chef Cindy Wolf, and on, I can't get it right either. Follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf, on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
On Instagram, I'm The Real Tony Foreman. You can download this or any one of our other episodes on all of which I'm much better spoken than I am today.
Oh boy.
From the WYPR website, wypr.org. And thanks today, as always, to Luke Spignall, who's our producer and the engineer of the program and who keeps us alive and going.
Thank you, Luke.
Through the process. Thanks so much for listening.
And we wish you a very, very happy holidays. Very.